Hello there and welcome. Today is Friday, February 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the gun debate continues.
Arming teachers, not a good idea.
New charges in the ongoing Russia investigation. The UN urges a ceasefire as a humanitarian crisis deepens in Syria. Also ahead, Black Panther movie mania continues. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, we are learning that an armed sheriff's deputy assigned to the Florida high school where 17 people were shot and killed has resigned rather than face suspension after an internal investigation showed he failed to enter the school to confront the gunman during the attack, according to the county sheriff. Deputy Scott Peterson was on duty and in uniform posted at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School and was the only law enforcement officer present at the campus during the six-minute rampage last Wednesday. Peterson's actions were caught on video during the massacre, which, by the way, ranks as the second deadliest shooting ever at a U.S. public school. And for a second day in a row, President Donald Trump spoke at length about school safety and guns.
We're going to do strong background checks. We're going to work on getting the age up to 21 instead of 18. We're getting rid of the bump stocks, and we're going to be focusing very strongly on mental health, because here's a case of mental health.
He also strongly advocated for arming teachers with guns to thwart campus massacres.
We have to harden our schools, not soften them up. A gun-free zone to a killer or somebody that wants to be a killer, that's like going in for the ice cream. That's like, here I am, take me.
But many teachers say they don't want to have to take on any other role but educate.
Arming teachers, not a good idea. I taught 8th grade science for over 30 years. I cannot imagine having the responsibility of carrying a gun, being trained to carry a gun, being trained to use a gun. I can't imagine being in an environment where guns are all around me. What's being described by the president and others sounds more like a prison to me, with the teachers as armed guards and the students as prisoners.
Trump suggested that up to 40% of classrooms could see teachers qualified in shooting guns and that such instructors would get a little bit of a bonus for such certification. Trump, who enjoyed strong support during his 2016 election campaign from the powerful National Rifle Association, which claims 5 million members, said he had spoken with NRA officials during the past 2 days and that the organization is ready to do things. Wayne LaPierre, the head of the National Rifle Association, spoke at a conservative political conference Thursday and slammed his organization's critics.
Each and every member of the National Rifle Association mourns the loss of the innocent and continues to keep their families and that community in our prayers. We share a goal of safe schools, safe neighborhoods, and a safe country. As usual, the opportunist wasted not one second to exploit tragedy for political gain. The breakback speed of calls for more gun control laws and the breathless national media eager to smear the NRA.
The powerful organization gave more than $11 million to the Trump campaign in 2016 and spent nearly $20 million attacking his Democratic Party challenger, Hillary Clinton. And in the wake of last week's school shooting, some victims and gun rights advocates are calling for a ban on semi-automatic rifles such as the AR-15, which was used in the shooting. Joining us now to discuss the ongoing gun debate is Paul Helmke, professor at Indiana University and the former head of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. So what's your take on what has transpired since this horrific tragedy and the response from students?
It's just so disappointing, and to see another mass public shooting, I'm angry and I'm depressed that once again we've allowed something like this to happen. But since the shooting on Valentine's Day, I've been encouraged by the activism of the young people there, and it really is something that gives me hope that maybe this time we'll do something different. We'll get results. I've I've been involved with this issue for probably 25 years as a mayor, as head of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. I've spoken out after a number of mass public shootings, and each time the response is the same. People offer prayers and sympathies. The NRA keeps its mouth shut, and by the time we're pushing legislation through, all the legislators, all the electeds have gone somewhere else for the most part. And this time, though, I think with the high school students speaking out, with the high school students organizing, with the fact that they were able to get a meeting with, some of them were able to get a meeting with President Trump yesterday, with the town hall forum on CNN, I'm thinking maybe this time it is going to be different.
These kids say they are not going to quit. They are going to be the last mass school shooting. But 24 hours later, we're seeing a pretty hard pushback from the NRA. Can they go up against the National Rifle Association and win?
That's what we'll have to see. But I've been encouraged. The young people that spoke last night were very articulate. They went up directly against Senator Rubio. They went up directly against the NRA representative. And I don't think they're going to be count. I think people this age, they've lived their whole life with these kind of shootings. I mean, Virginia Tech would have happened when they were 5 years old or something. Sandy Hook would have happened when they were in eighth grade. They're seeing it come back again. And when you think about the fact that just this school year alone, we've seen three out of the top 10 mass public shootings in the U.S. With the Sutherland, with the Texas church shooting, with the Las Vegas shooting, and now this shooting, these kids are living it. And they ask the question, why haven't the adults done anything about it? Why haven't our electeds done anything about it? And they're young enough, they're articulate enough, they know social media, they have organizing skills that I think they're going to continue forward with this. I don't think they're going to give up. One of the things I've learned over the years, the people that are the best volunteers, the people that stay with it, the people that are committed are the ones that have been directly affected by gun violence, have had family members or friends directly affected by it. And there's more and more of those each year, and this shooting brought up a lot more. And with social media, I think young people feel more connected. Even if they don't know somebody directly, they feel tied to it.
But you've got the NRA sending out threats to members, and at the Conservative Political Action mm-hmm. Committee conference,
right.
Basically saying that the Democrats are trying to take away their guns and some of the usual talking points, but they up until now have worked, and it is a big organization mm-hmm. with a lot of power,
well,
a lot of political power, and
a
lot of money.
They're very powerful. They're very skillful. They basically have learned all the lessons on how to keep their business model going. And it's a great business model. It basically, the more shootings, the more people want to buy guns, the more guns there are, the more gun violence we see, and that keeps the NRA where they are now.
So what is the solution to the gun violence? Because nobody expects that the Second Amendment will be overturned. It doesn't mm-hmm. appear that there's a whole lot of will from politicians to even ban assault weapons.
Well, first of all, we need dialogue. And that's one of the things that is happening after this shooting. And again, when I watched the town hall meeting in Florida, after Virginia Tech, after all these other shootings that we've had, generally you see some sort of mass display of sorrow and concern, and people put the flowers down and the names down, and there's usually a big event where people read the names and they hold up candles or the flashlights or the iPhones, and there's that catharsis, and that's important. And that's it. Last night ended with the poem and with a song and with that same sort of catharsis. But for the 2 hours before that, it was questions about why aren't we doing things? And it's that dialogue that's needed. There's no easy answers. The sad thing is that we have talked more about this issue than Congress has talked about it in the last 5 years. That's what we need. We need them to talk. There are solutions out there. There are things that can be done. I get people a lot of times that say, you know, gun control doesn't work. And my response is, how do we know? We haven't really tried it. We don't do much in this country. The Second Amendment is not the barrier. Justice Scalia said in the Heller case in 08 that this right, the Second Amendment rights, like other rights, are not unlimited, and that you can have restrictions on who gets guns, how guns are sold, how guns are carried, how guns are stored, and even what kind of guns they are. So first thing we need to do is push back on the electeds who say, I support the Second Amendment, and say, that's not the issue. The issue is, what are you going to do for public safety? What are you going to do for public health? And then start talking about, let's strengthen that background check system. President Trump says he wants a better background check system. The NRA says that at times. How do we make it a better background check system? You make it a better system by making sure you have background checks on all sales, and by making sure that we get better records into that. That's one of the things the NRA spokesperson talked about last night. And get those records into the system. And then then let's take the response that everyone has. This shooter shouldn't have gotten a gun. Our current laws don't prohibit this kind of person from getting a gun. Unless we change our laws to do that, these people are going to continue to get guns. So let's change the laws to make it harder for dangerous people, people that we know are dangerous, to get guns. President Trump says he believes that. The NRA says they believe that. Let's call them on it and see if we can pass something that does that.
All right, that's Paul Helmke, professor and former head of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The UN Atomic Agency says Iran is complying with nuclear accord. U.S. law enforcement officials announced the largest ever elderly fraud case. Soft skills education kicks off in African schools. And another 1,500 prisoners have been released in Ethiopia. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. Special Counsel Robert Mueller filed additional criminal charges Thursday against President Donald Trump's ex-campaign aides, Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, that include bank and tax fraud, stepping up pressure in a legal battle that started last year. They were among the first to be charged as part of Mueller's ongoing investigation into whether the Trump presidential campaign colluded with Russia to influence the 2016 election. Russia has denied meddling in the campaign, and Trump has denied any collusion took place. Joining us now to discuss this latest turn of events is Robert Deitz, former special counsel of the CIA and NSA, and currently a professor at the Schar School of Public Policy at George Mason University. So we heard there might be a plea deal from Mr. Gates, but so far we just see these new charges. What's going on here?
The traditional way of going after this kind of an investigation is you start with the bottom feeders and you move up. And you do this for two reasons. First, the people at the very bottom are often, while they may be guilty of one thing or another, they're not really the people that are really the targets. And B, their liability is often quite limited, and so by pleading guilty, they can get a very good arrangement from a prosecutor. Answer one.
Okay.
Answer two is lawyer fees. You know, if you're Paul Manafort, if you're Donald Trump, you can afford to pay hefty legal fees. If you're a young person I gather he has three or four kids, you got young kids, you've got a mortgage, and facing the possibility of long-term imprisonment as well as crushing attorney's fees, you're often going to plead. And that's what I think is happening here.
Okay, so we know that Mr. Gates doesn't have a lot of money for attorneys.
Right.
And he's...
By the way, do you know what a white-collar defense would cost him? It'd be in the neighborhood of $1 million.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for anybody. Well, you know, for most of us, it's a hell of a lot of money.
Right. So what do you think he might know that would be helpful to this case? And what does this all have to do with the investigation of whether or not there was collusion between the Trump campaign?
Well, look, I can speculate so long as you understand that this is raw speculation. My instinct, and again, it's nothing more than an instinct, is that the real vulnerabilities of Mr. Trump go through his real estate enterprise. It is well known that oligarchs in Russia, oligarchs in the Middle East, and so forth, buy real property and park it. In fact, you may be aware that in London they're actually proposing a tax on unoccupied condos and apartments, because these are, you know, when things go south, if you're in the Middle East or in Russia, you've got real property located in a stable regime with a strong government. And so my instinct, and again, it's nothing more than an instinct, is that Mr. Trump's risk is in the purchase of real property through laundered money.
What would this gentleman have to do with President Trump?
I don't know, but remember, Mr. Manafort has got problems in the money laundering department. That was the indictment. It is possible that Gates and or Manafort have some knowledge of goings on with the Trump family group. Again, this is speculation. I don't have the facts.
So where do you think this whole investigation is going. Are there any clues from what you've seen so far as to what sort of, is he trying to build a case, or
yes,
is he just trying
yes.
to find out what happened?
Well, he's certainly trying to find out what happened, but he's doing that in connection with building a case. Again, you start with at the bottom of the food chain, and you move on up. You know, if you're a young person facing crushing legal fees, facing potentially really serious jail time, you begin to ask yourself hard questions. And I believe that Mr. Mueller is just methodically going up the chain.
Do you expect this to drag on for a lot longer?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I always found it amusing. Back in, if you recall, I think it was November or October, Mr. Trump's lawyers, according to Mr. Trump, were assuring him that it'd be over by Christmas. And I remember, laughing out loud when I read that. I'd be surprised if it's finished by the end of this summer. Hey, Mr. I know Bob Mueller. I don't know him well, but I've worked with him. And mm-hmm. if I had to pick one person in the world that I would not want on my case, it would be Bob Mueller. He is careful. He's methodical. He will not tolerate sloppiness. And any indictment that's brought is going to be a very strong indictment.
All right. Robert Deitz, former senior counsel for the CIA and NSA. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed Wednesday to the Security Council to approve an urgent 30-day ceasefire across Syria and to help the 400,000 besieged residents of eastern Ghouta, who he said are living a hell on earth. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
In recent weeks, they have intensified a military offensive trying to retake the opposition-held territory, which is near Damascus.
But I believe eastern Ghouta cannot wait. And so my appeal to all those involved is for an immediate suspension of all war activities in eastern Ghouta, allowing for humanitarian aid to reach all those in need.
Guterres appealed to the parties to allow for the evacuation of the 700 people urgently awaiting medical attention.
This is a human tragedy that is unfolding in front of our eyes, and I don't think we can let things go on happening in this horrendous way.
The Security Council is currently discussing a draft resolution that would implement a 30-day Syria-wide pause in the fighting. It would also demand access for weekly humanitarian aid convoys and for medical evacuations. It's not clear whether there is consensus in the council. Russia's ambassador said there should be a public council meeting on Thursday to discuss eastern Ghouta and to let members present their understanding of the situation. The United States says it supports the ceasefire and has called for a de-escalation of violence.
I think that it is time for us to realize that we can't continue to look away.
In the meantime, the violence continues. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Kenya's High Court Thursday began hearing arguments in a case that challenges part of the penal code seen as targeting the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender communities. The National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission argues that sections of the code are in breach of the Constitution and deny basic rights by criminalizing consensual same-sex relations between adults. The commission's executive director, Eric Gattari.
The case today about is a hearing seeking to decriminalize the criminalization of homosexual conduct in Kenya. Homosexuality, which we are challenging today, is consensual same-sex intimacy, which is criminalized in our law. And our argument is that it's unconstitutional, it encourages discrimination, and violates the rights of human beings in Kenya.
Many countries across Africa have laws against homosexuality. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at what's happening on social media. For that, we hear from VOA's Doug Bernard. Hi, Doug. What's happening?
I think it's fair to say that social media is a bit roiled up right now. People have a lot of strong feelings about a lot of, in some cases, very emotional topics. And I thought maybe today we'd just take a little break from that and instead look at a story that involves social media that also seems to be getting some people riled up, unfortunately. This week, Twitter began basically purging all the various user accounts and whatnot of automated accounts and bot accounts. Now, they're a little bit different in how they work, but essentially they do the same thing. They're just kind of constantly generating material that humans really aren't generating, but they do so, you know, in an automated fashion. They can do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of in an hour. This is the so-called, you know, phony, false follower phenomenon and whatnot. And, you know, when you get hundreds, thousands of these bots doing this, it really can kind of distort what, you know, it looks like people are talking about and what they're feeling out there, at least on Twitter. So Twitter began basically cutting back, eliminating a lot of bot accounts. They have ways of telling these things or not. And it turns out that, generally speaking, more conservatives have these bot followers than mainstream, liberal, middle of the road, those kinds of commentators. And so conservatives are really, really upset. They have started this hashtag Twitter lockout. They think Twitter is intentionally targeting conservative views. Here's James O'Keefe, conservative activist, quote, "Looks like the thousands of Twitter users committed the thought crime of tweeting about God, the American flag, guns, and were taken off the platform. Others have been sharing the same thoughts. The Twitter purge is real. I woke up and saw I lost 100 or so followers," wrote Dan Bonino. He's a conservative columnist on a Fox TV network. Now, Twitter admits that, yes, they are purging some accounts. No, they're not locking anybody out. And more specifically, no, they're not targeting anyone's political views, that this is apolitical, and it really is an effort to kind of limit the number of bots. It's interesting that Twitter is doing this now because, of course, bots mean traffic, and traffic means good numbers for Twitter, and that means more money coming in. All of this has led some conservatives to begin embracing a new social network called Gab. It's ad-free. It promises it'll always be that way. And if you have any doubts about whether it's retailing itself to conservative, first off, its logo is the face of a frog. Now, that generally might not mean anything, but in the United States, the frog, particularly a character, animated character known as Pepe the Frog, has really become a symbol of the alt-right, has been sort of co-opted by them. Secondly, I just did a quick search for Gab, and Google was very helpful, found it, but it also shared with me what people who were searching for Gab, what else they were searching for. These are some of the top items that they were searching for: the Drudge Report, the Gateway Pundit, Breitbart News, and the Daily Stormer. For those of you not familiar with any or all of those, they are all somewhere between conservative, hard conservative, and downright fanatical. That's just sort of a sense as to what's happening out there. Conservatives upset. They feel they're being kicked off Twitter. Twitter says, no, you're not. You just have to work with us as we try and deal with the bot problem.
All right, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. That's VOA's Doug Bernard. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, a Black Panther-themed pop-up bar in Washington, D.C. is offering fans an interactive entrance into the make-believe land of Wakanda. The four-day event provided more than just a space for Marvel fans, though, but a chance to pay homage to the movie that they say breaks the mold on stories about the Black experience.
Greg Jackson has been a fan of Black Panther since his youth.
Not only is he a superhero, he's richer than Iron Man, he's smarter than the Beast, he's smarter than Hulk, and he's stronger than almost all of the Avengers that he fights with.
With the Marvel character finally hit in the big screen, Jackson and his friends wanted more than just to see the movie.
This isn't a Marvel endorsed thing.
So they created a pop-up bar as an ode to the men and women of Wakanda.
Growing up, I was constantly kind of hit with like negative perspectives or negative stories about being a black man or being black in America.
But that changed after he picked up a comic book about a superhero from Africa.
I found this hero who looked like me, who came from Africa, which is a place I should be proud of. But a lot of times I was, you know, made fun of for it. But seeing him be a leader was such an exciting thing.
As you enter Jackson's Wakanda, African pop beats usher you into a Black Panther playground with comic book pages plastered all around.
A lot of people don't know that he dated Storm and they actually wound up getting married.
Cocktails named after vibranium, the source of Black Panther's strength, a wilderness escape, and a throne room all offer a glimpse into the superhero's world. For patrons, it's not just about having a good time.
Although Wakanda is a fictional country, it still gives us a chance to connect with the motherland, if you will. And that's something that a lot of us have never had a chance to do before.
Tickets staggered in two-hour blocks sold out so quickly that organizers decided to extend it one more day. But with the temporary Black Panther-themed bar now closed, the only way for fans to experience the imaginary country of Wakanda is at the movies. Jason Samuelny, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria's health, education, agriculture, and governance sectors will get an extra assist from the United States. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced $89 million in additional development assistance to Nigeria to continue its support for development goals outlined in a Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments signed in 2015. Nearly half of the new funding, $44 million, will support HIV/AIDS control through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR. The remainder will help Northeast Nigeria increase agricultural productivity, economic growth, and resilience through the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative, strengthen education, support good governance, and improve water and sanitation infrastructure. The new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year assistance agreement to $808.5 million. USAID collaborated with the Nigerian Ministry of Budget and National Planning, the Nigerian Ministries of Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, and state-level government counterparts, among others, to structure the bilateral assistance agreement, which runs through 2020. In addition to the development assistance funding, the United States provides humanitarian assistance to people affected by the ongoing conflict and severe food insecurity in Nigeria and throughout the Lake Chad Basin. The U.S. government, led by USAID, has provided more than $526.7 million in humanitarian assistance since 2017 and continues to be the single largest bilateral humanitarian donor to the region. This new assistance underscores how important the relationship between Nigeria and the United States continues to be. USAID Nigeria Deputy Assistant Administrator Julie Conan said, "Our strong partnership with Nigeria and its institutions will help Nigeria's efforts to improve its health, education, agriculture, and governance systems where they are needed most throughout the country."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
From Washington, this is